This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
It's time for the New Yorker. Since 1925, it's been the world's source for the finest in art and fiction, sophisticated reviews, humor, commentary, and news. Stay tuned for this week's Culture Blast from the one and only New Yorker, right now on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is the New Yorker, and I'm your reader, Dale, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the November 3rd issue, copyright 2025, Condé Nast. On the cover this week, a watercolor painting of a scene from Manhattan. On a broad walkway beside the Hudson River, a crowd of people go about their business, going in various directions. Most are on foot. In the foreground, a young man, casually dressed in a hoodie and jacket, rides a scooter, leaning forward with a grin. Trailing behind him is another young man, also in a hoodie, riding a skateboard. He clutches the first young man's shirt as he skates behind him. He crouches and smiles as he rides. A young woman in a jacket, pink track pants, and headphones follows behind them on inline skates. A pedestrian bridge stretches away over the river, connecting to an artificial island built on the water in the background. That island is composed of several densely packed individual structures of unusual and modern-looking architectural design. Each is a large tulip-shaped pot rising out of the water, narrow and broadening to a wide circular top. They rise dozens of feet above the heads of the pedestrians on the bridge. The tops of the structures together make up an upper level of the island, and on that level stand trees and other greenery. Some of the trees are turning autumn yellow and orange, others remain green. A bluish-gray sky with puffy clouds stretches above the island and the water toward the horizon. The blue sky blends to pale red, suggesting sunset. The illustration is titled Racing Through Fall, and it is by Victoria Tentler Krulov. The New Yorker Online provides this commentary on the image written by Francois Mouly. New York's sprawling parks can be both a respite from and an amplification of the rhythms of the city. For the cover of the November 3, 2025 issue, the artist Victoria Tentler Krulov painted the colorful scene that takes place in front of Little Island, one of the newer additions to the roster. Nothing beats a ride or a stroll along Hudson River Park on a nice day, Tentler Krulov said. I love not only watching all the performative fitness, but also observing the nooks and crannies that grow, bloom, and change colors with the seasons. The next article is from The Talk of the Town, and it is titled, Comment, Teardown. The surprise and shock that so many people have registered at the photographs of Donald Trump's destruction of the east wing of the White House, soon to be replaced by his own ostentatious and overscaled ballroom, is itself in a way surprising and shocking. On the long list of Trumpian depredations, the rushed demolition might seem a relatively minor offense. After months marked by corruption, violence, and the open perversion of law, to gasp in outrage at the loss of a few tons of masonry and mortar might seem oddly misjudged. And yet it isn't. We are creatures of symbols, and our architecture tells us who we are. John Ruskin, the greatest of architectural critics, observed that a nation writes its history in many books, but that the book of its buildings is the most enduring. The faith in order and proportion embodied in the Alhambra, the romance of modernity caught in the Eiffel Tower's lattice of iron, these are not ideas imposed on buildings, but ideals that the buildings themselves express, more lastingly than words can. Among them, not least, is the modest, egoless ideal of democratic tradition captured so perfectly in such American monuments as the Lincoln Memorial, which shows not a hero but a man seated in grave contemplation. The same restrained values of democracy have always marked the White House, a stately house, but not an imperial one. It is the people's house. But it has also historically been a family house with family quarters and a family scale. It's a little place by the standards of monarchy, and blessedly so, fitting for a democracy in which even the biggest boss is there for a brief time and at the people's pleasure. As Ronald Reagan said, after a victory more decisive than Trump could ever dream of, the president is merely a temporary resident holding the keys for a fixed term. That was the beauty of it. The East Wing has never been a place of grandeur. The structure as we knew it was built in the anxious years of the Second World War. It was Franklin Roosevelt's attempt to regularize a jumble of service spaces and, not incidentally, to carve out a secure refuge beneath them. But it quickly became a center of quiet power. Eleanor Roosevelt hosted women journalists there. 2 decades later, Jacqueline Kennedy presided over a different kind of transformation from the same offices, founding the White House Historical Association. The wing's very plainness came to symbolize the functional modesty of democratic government, a space for staff, not spectacle, for the sustaining rituals of civic life, not the exhibition of personal glory. All of that is now gone. The act of destruction is precisely the point, a kind of performance piece meant to display Trump's arbitrary power over the presidency, including its physical seat. He asks permission of no one, destroys what he wants, when he wants. As many have noted, one of Trump's earliest public acts, having promised the Metropolitan Museum of Art the beautiful limestone reliefs from the facade of the old Bonwit Teller building, was to jackhammer them to dust in a fit of impatience. Trump apologists say that earlier presidents altered the White House too. Didn't Jimmy Carter install solar panels? Didn't George H.W. Bush build a horseshoe pit? Didn't Barack Obama put in a basketball court? What's the fuss? And anyway, who but elitists would object to a big ballroom that looks like the banquet hall of a third-rate casino? Who decides what's decorous and what's vulgar? Even the White House Historical Association, with a caution that has become typical of this dark time, confines itself to stating that it has been allowed to make a digital record of what's being destroyed, as though that were a defense rather than an epitaph. This, of course, is the standard line of Trump apologetics. Some obvious outrage is identified, and defenders immediately scour history for an earlier, vaguely similar act by a president who actually respected the Constitution. It's a form of mismatched matching. If Trump blows up boats with unknown men aboard, well, didn't Obama use drones against alleged terrorists? Yes, but within a process designed, however imperfectly, to preserve a chain of command and a vestige of due process. If Trump posts a video featuring himself as the combat pilot he never was, dropping excrement on peaceful protesters, well, didn't Lyndon Johnson swear at his aides from his seat on the John? What's the fuss? The jabs and insults of earlier presidents, though, however rough, stayed within the bounds of democratic discourse, the basic rule being that the other side also gets to make its case. Even Richard Nixon sought out student protesters one early morning at the Lincoln Memorial and tried to understand what drove them. So it was with the White House. Earlier alterations were made incrementally and only after much deliberation. When Harry Truman added a not very grand balcony to the executive residence, the move was controversial, but the construction was overseen by a bipartisan commission. By contrast, the new project, bankrolled by big tech firms and crypto moguls, is one of excess and self-advertisement. The difference between the Truman balcony and the Trump ballroom is all the difference in the world. It is a difference of process and procedure. Two words so essential to the rule of law and equality, yet doomed always to seem feeble beside the orgiastic showcase of power. That is the rhetorical fragility of liberal democracy, its reliance on rules rather than on rage. If the White House must be remade, let there be a plan. Let it be debated. Let the financing be transparent and free of kickbacks and corruption. It isn't complicated, and it's the very principle at the heart of the American Revolution. Following rules is not weakness. It is the breaking of them that is the indulgence of insecure tyrants who feel most alive in acts of real and symbolic violence. Architecture embodies values. It is not merely a receptacle of them. Simple proportions and human-scale spaces don't just suggest the spirit of a democratic nation. They are that spirit in three dimensions with doors and windows. Reverence for the past and reluctance to destroy until the risk of destruction are fully known is not timidity but wisdom in architecture as in life. To conserve, after all, is the essence of conservatism. The shock that images of the destruction provoke, the grief so many have felt, is not an overreaction to the loss of a beloved building. It is a recognition of something deeper, the central values of democracy being demolished before our eyes. Now we do not only sense it, we see it. And that article was written by Adam Gopnik. The next article from Brave New World Department, and it's titled Information Overload: Inside the Data Centers That Train AI and Drain the Electrical Grid. And this article was written by Stephen Witt. Drive in almost any direction from almost any American city, and soon enough, you'll arrive at a data center, a giant white box rising from graded earth, flanked by generators and fenced like a prison yard. Data centers for artificial intelligence are the new American factory. Packed with computing equipment, they absorb information and emit AI. Since the launch of ChatGPT in 2022, they have begun to multiply at an astonishing rate. I do guess that a lot of the world gets covered in data centers over time, Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, recently said. The leading independent operator of AI data centers in the United States is CoreWeave, which was founded 8 years ago as a casual experiment. In 2017, traders at a middling New York hedge fund decided to begin mining cryptocurrency, which they used as the entry fee for their fantasy football league. To mine the crypto, they bought a graphics processing unit, a powerful microchip made by the company NVIDIA. The GPU was marketed to video gamers, but NVIDIA offered software that turned it into a low-budget supercomputer. It was so successful from a return of capital perspective that we started scaling it, Brian Venturo, one of CoreWeave's co-founders, told me. If you make your money back in like 5 days, you want to do that a lot. Within a year, the traders had quit the hedge fund business and bought several thousand GPUs, which they ran from Venturo's grandfather's garage in New Jersey. After the cryptocurrency market crashed in 2018, CoreWeave acquired more microchips from insolvent miners. Before long, the firm had built a platform that allowed outside customers to access the GPUs. Then in 2022, Venturo came upon Stable Diffusion, an image generation AI. He fed the AI descriptions of different scenes, and it returned accurate, beautiful illustrations. This is going to enrapture the entire world, Venturo remembers thinking. Stable Diffusion had been trained on NVIDIA equipment that was similar to CoreWeave's. Venturo and his co-founders sensed the business opportunity of a lifetime. CoreWeave raised $100 million and used almost all of it to buy NVIDIA hardware. Soon, Jensen Huang, NVIDIA's CEO, arranged a meeting with the group. He spent about 10 minutes making fun of me for being from New Jersey, Venturo said. But in time, NVIDIA bought a portion of the company. By the middle of 2022, CoreWeave was running a new kind of business, connecting AI developers with warehouses full of NVIDIA equipment. Modern data center construction began in the 90s with the arrival of the commercial internet. Data centers hosted websites, coordinated email, processed payments, and streamed video and music. Amazon was particularly aggressive about building data centers. So many were constructed in Loudoun County, Virginia, that the area became known as Data Center Alley. Even before the AI boom, data centers were profitable. In some years, Amazon's web services division earned more than the company's retail operation on a fraction of the sales. But the arrival of NVIDIA's GPUs and the onset of large-scale AI training transformed the data center business. ChatGPT launched in November 2022 and exploded in popularity. "The world goes bananas," Venturo said. Microsoft partnered with OpenAI to provide the data center capacity that ChatGPT needed to function. When Microsoft couldn't keep up with the demand, it turned to CoreWeave. Working with NVIDIA hardware has become a status symbol, a sign that one is serious about AI. Talking with engineers about the equipment, I was reminded of the time I saw a snaking line of young men standing in the cold to buy sneakers from the streetwear brand Supreme. Earlier this year, CoreWeave went public. Venturo and his co-founders are now billionaires. The company owns several hundred thousand GPUs, and its platform trains models for Meta and other leading labs in addition to OpenAI. This summer, I visited a CoreWeave facility on the outskirts of Las Vegas. The building, a large warehouse, was surrounded by a thick fence and dotted at regular intervals with security cameras. I went through a turnstile where I was greeted by a security guard wearing a bulletproof vest and a holstered taser. After surrendering my phone, I took two lime green earplugs from a dispenser and entered the facility. I was joined by three CoreWeave engineers, geeks who had adapted to hyperscale capitalism as Darwin's finches had to the Galapagos Islands. Jacob Yunt from corporate was lean and eloquent with a swooping part in his hair. Christopher Conley, an enthusiastic explainer with sunglasses and a beard, oversaw the hardware. Sean Anderson, a 7-foot-tall former college basketball center, wore a shirt that read, "More nodes." The nodes in question were shallow trays of computing equipment, each weighing around 70 pounds and holding four water-cooled GPUs, along with an array of additional gear. 18 of these trays are stacked, then connected with cables to a control unit to form the NVIDIA GB300 computing rack, which is a little taller than a refrigerator and costs a few million dollars. In a busy year, a typical rack will use more electricity than 100 homes, dozens of them stretched into the distance. CoreWeave keeps its racks in white metal cabinets to help them stay cool and to dampen noise. Conley unlatched a door to show me a rack in action, and I was buffeted with air. The noise was unholy, as if I'd open a broom closet and found an active jet engine inside. I watched the blinking lights and the spinning of the fans. "Tinnitus is an occupational hazard," Conley shouted at me. I looked around. There were hundreds of identical cabinets in the facility. Above us was a metal catwalk lined with power distributors for the computing equipment. I thought of monks in cloisters, soldiers in barracks, prisoners in cells. What type of person voluntarily worked in such a place, I wondered. I was told by HR that I can't ask this kind of question anymore, but I like to hire people that can endure a lot of pain, Yunt later said. Endurance athletes, that sort of thing. CoreWeave wouldn't tell me which customer was using its technology that day, although Yunt suggested that the training run we were witnessing was a modest one. He began to detail the configuration of the rack. Unable to hear what he was saying, I nodded sagely as if in a conversation at a nightclub. Even with the plugs in, my ears were starting to ring, and I was developing a headache. Yunt turned to me. "Sometimes a customer will tie up this entire place for weeks at a time," he shouted. His parted hair began to flap in the fan exhausts. "We call those hero runs." CoreWeave's hardware can train an AI from scratch to completion. Software developers, typically at a workstation in Silicon Valley, upload to the data center a file of numbers known as weights and a vast array of training data, which might be text or images or medical records or really anything at all. In their initial configuration, the weights are random, and the AI has no capabilities. The AI is then exposed to a slice of the training data and asked to offer a prediction about what should ensue. The next few letters in a sentence say, "An untrained AI will invariably get this prediction wrong, but at least it will learn what not to do." The weights must be modified to absorb this new piece of information. The math is unwieldy and is especially dependent on an operation known as matrix multiplication. Beauty is the first test. There is no permanent place in the world for ugly mathematics, the mathematician G.H. Hardy wrote in 1940. But matrix multiplication, to which our civilization is now devoting so many of its marginal resources, has all the elegance of a man hammering a nail into a board. It is possessed of neither beauty nor symmetry. In fact, in matrix multiplication, A times B is not the same as B times A. As the matrices increase in size, the arithmetic requires great computational power to solve. The latest large language models can involve about a trillion individual weights. A weeks-long hero run for such a model can use tens of thousands of GPUs and require 10 trillion trillion operations, which is more than the number of observable stars in the universe. Data centers must cooperate with local electric utilities to manage these training runs. The water coursing above CoreWeave's microchips enters at room temperature, but leaves warmer than a hot bath. It is cooled in a storage tank before being recycled into the system. The temperature, humidity, and particulate count of the air inside the room are also carefully monitored. "Condensation is our enemy," Conley said gravely. All these microchips, all this electricity, all these fans, all this money, all these data, all these water cooling pumps and cables, all of it is there to tune the weights, this little file of numbers, which is small enough to fit on an external hard drive. A great deal depends on this well-tempered collection of synthetic neurons. The money spent to develop it and others like it represents one of the largest deployments of capital in human history. When the finished product is ready, clones of the weights are distributed to data centers around the country, where they can be accessed through the internet, a process known as inference. Users ask questions, prompting the AI to produce individual units of intelligence called tokens. A token might be a small square of pixels or a fragment of a word. To write a college term paper, an AI might produce about 5,000 tokens, consuming enough electricity to run a microwave oven at full power for about 3 minutes. As AI fields increasingly complex requests for video, for audio, for therapy, the need for computing power will increase many times over. Multiply that by the more than 800 million people who use ChatGPT every week, and the data center explosion makes sense. ChatGPT is now more popular than Wikipedia. Young people refer to it as chat, which has come to signify AI in the way that Google signifies internet search. I spoke to a data center executive with Microsoft who thinks that we will demand AI constantly in the future, just as we demand the internet or electricity, and that current data center construction may be insufficient. I am more concerned that we are underbuilding rather than overbuilding, the executive said. Microsoft is one of the dominant operators of data centers, and this business has become the primary driver of growth for the American economy. Although the company still makes operating systems and office software, it is investors' excitement about data centers that has propelled Microsoft to around a $4 trillion valuation, making it the world's second most valuable firm. NVIDIA, which makes microchips that Microsoft uses, is number one. It is difficult to get inside a Microsoft data center for the same reason that it is difficult to get inside Fort Knox. The AIs under development in these facilities are worth a fortune. Traditionally, when you want to steal something that's worth an insane amount of money, it's like, back up the truck, Peter Solanke, the chief technology officer of CoreWeave, told me. Here, you have somebody get in with a thumb drive, and it can fit the entirety of OpenAI's IP on it. But this fall, after what felt like 200 phone calls, I was invited to tour an enormous Microsoft data center campus under construction. I agreed to take no photographs, to leave my phone outside, to limit what I described of the interior, and not to reveal where in the United States the facility was situated. In September, I took a long drive to the middle of nowhere. The data center was surrounded by farmland, and at least three other companies were building data centers in the area. The fields were crisscrossed by a tangle of wires from high-voltage electric towers, and large, hideous boxes were popping up everywhere. The exterior of the site did not display any Microsoft branding or any signage at all. Behind a fence and past several vehicle checkpoints, the campus was a spacious expanse of nothing, except for one corner, which was populated by a row of numbered sheds. The sheds were white, narrow, tall, and several football fields in length. They reminded me of the livestock barns I visited as a child at the Minnesota State Fair. Flanking each shed was a row of diesel generators and industrial air conditioners. At the time of my visit, there were 5 sheds, and the plan called for roughly 10. There were construction vehicles everywhere, cherry pickers, earth movers, trucks carrying spools of cable. Someone had done a bit of landscaping in front of the shed I was visiting, and a few small plants grew in the shade. Inside, I met with Judy Priest and Steve Solomon, both Microsoft executives. They have spent their professional lives managing warehouse-sized computers. Priest, an electrical engineer, is a graduate of MIT with high sculpted eyebrows and wild blonde hair. Solomon, a mechanical engineer, responded to my questions with long technical monologues. Both seemed thrilled to participate in the new industrial revolution. Priest excitedly described a recent medical visit after which she'd been sent an AI-assisted summary of her conversation with her doctor. Solomon, who'd been having trouble with his stereo, had taken a picture of the connections in the back and uploaded it to chat. The AI, he told me, had returned 7 possible troubleshooting solutions. Here, his voice took on a slight intonation, which I took to mean that he was expressing an emotion. Number 3 worked, he said. After donning a pair of steel-toed boots and watching a PowerPoint presentation, I passed through a security checkpoint and into the inner sanctum. The facility was quieter, tidier, and more spacious than the CoreWeave Center. Hundreds of identical blinking banks of servers and computing equipment attached to cooling stations and humming noisily took up much of the floor. Zip-tied bundles ran along the ceiling, wires for electricity, cables for data, pipes for water and air. The cables connected to a larger bundle of cable, which linked with the other sheds, allowing all of them to act as a single unified computer. Across all 5 sheds, the area dedicated to computing was the equivalent of 20 football fields. Priest explained that an advanced training run could tie up the entire system for a month. I stood with a technician at a control center, monitoring the electrical draw. We watched as the power spiked. The computer was processing training data. Then it receded. Now it was writing the results to the file. These pulses repeated as the AI moved from one checkpoint to the next. Somewhere inside the building, the model was improving. Somewhere inside the building, the computer was learning how to think. Leaving the data center, I found myself desperate for human contact. A half mile down the road, the top of a grain silo peeked out from behind a data center construction site. I drove through a landscape of gray buildings, irrigation canals, power lines, and verdant fields before arriving at a dusty yard crowded with tractors and pickup trucks. There, I found a fourth-generation alfalfa farmer wearing blue jeans, a plaid shirt, and a baseball cap with a tanker truck embroidered on it. The farmer gestured to the power lines cutting through his field, which the local utility had installed in the 1940s. "We always considered those things a liability," he said. "We thought they depressed the value of the land." But now, he said, access to a power substation was worth a fortune. One of his neighbors claimed that he had sold a plot of farmland to a data center developer for more than $1 million an acre, more than the farm would return in a lifetime. Piece by piece, the farmer said, his family was doing the same. There was a new data center to the north of the farm and another under construction to the east. Microsoft's sprawling facility dominated the horizon. It sat on a patch of dirt his family had worked since 1979. He told me that he was planning on moving out soon. The surroundings felt unfit for agriculture or even for human life. I asked the farmer if he had noticed any environmental effects from living next to the data centers. The impact on the water supply, he told me, was negligible. "Honestly, we probably use more water than they do," he said. "Training a state-of-the-art AI requires less water than is used on a square mile of farmland in a year." Power is a different story. The farmer said that the local utility was set to hike rates for the third time in 3 years, with the most recent proposed hike being in the double digits. The biggest loss was the nutrient-rich topsoil, which his family had maintained with careful crop rotations. "Microsoft brought in an excavator and ripped it all out in a day," he said, as if speaking of a lost heirloom. 6 to 10 feet of it, all gone. We watched as a yellow dog got up, walked in a small circle, then went back to sleep in the shade of a tree. Behind the tree, and dwarfing it, was a giant rectangular warehouse. I asked the farmer if he ever used AI. "I use Claude," he said. "Google sucks now." Data centers are beginning to put intense pressure on America's electrical grid. In 1999, Constellation Energy purchased the sole functioning reactor at Three Mile Island and operated it for the next 20 years. In 2019, the company shut the reactor down, concluding that it was economically unviable. Brian Hansen, the executive who oversees Constellation's nuclear generation fleet, threw a farewell party for employees. "There was food there, but nobody ate it," he said. "The moon was like a funeral." Parties may soon return to Three Mile Island. Constellation has announced that it will reopen the facility in 2027, rebranding it as the Crane Clean Energy Center. A large contract with Microsoft made the difference. "If you told me we'd be reopening this plant just 8 years later, I never would have believed you," Hansen said. The second reactor at the site, which released a cloud of radioactive gas into the atmosphere in 1979, will remain dormant. Energy executives such as Hansen have been bombarded by requests for more power. Data centers are perhaps bigger by an order of magnitude than anything we've connected to the grid before, he said. If you think about the city of Philadelphia, its load is about 1 gigawatt. Now imagine adding 1 gigawatt-sized data centers to the grid, and not just one, but multiples of them. When a data center comes online, retail customers usually help to foot the electric bill. American Utilities sought almost $30 billion in retail rate increases in the first half of 2025. This spring, utilities requested almost double the rate hikes from the same period a year earlier. An analysis by Bloomberg estimated that in areas near data centers, wholesale electricity costs have risen by more than 200% in the past 5 years, and rates will probably continue to increase. Power plants can't produce nearly enough electricity to meet the demand. Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, has said that the U.S. must add 92 gigawatts of power to the national supply to meet data center demand, some 92 Philadelphias. If there isn't enough power, American AI developers might lose out to the Middle East and China, where enormous data center projects are already underway. Data centers must operate 24 hours a day to be economically viable. The Microsoft facility I visited is permitted 5 minutes and 15 seconds of unscheduled downtime per year. Renewable energy sources like wind and solar, which depend on the weather, can currently meet only a fraction of this demand. Nuclear power won't save us either, at least not anytime soon. Hansen said that it would be years before any new large-scale nuclear reactors could be constructed in the U.S. With envy in his voice, he told me, China is building 26 nuclear reactors. In the near term, new data centers will largely be powered by fossil fuels. Developers are purchasing land near natural gas deposits, such as the Marcellus Shale, a gigantic underground gas reservoir in Appalachia. In April, Homer City Redevelopment, a group based in Pennsylvania, announced that it intended to convert a mothballed coal plant outside Pittsburgh into the largest natural gas power plant in the country, dedicated almost exclusively to data centers and capable of producing roughly 4.5 gigawatts of electricity. According to an environmental nonprofit, the Homer City plant could release as much as 4 million pounds of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every hour, about the same as 4 million idling cars. The Earth is now warming at an estimated 3/10 of a degree Celsius per decade, roughly 10 times faster than at the end of an ice age. After the last ice age ended, the oceans rose 400 feet. Adding plants like Homer City and scores more worldwide will speed this catastrophic timeline. The Trump administration has responded by restricting the use of the phrase climate change in government communications. Data centers also cause local pollution. Elon Musk's XAI has built a natural gas-powered data center in Memphis near the black neighborhood of Boxtown. The area, which already had the highest rate of emergency room visits for asthma in Tennessee, saw levels of nitrogen dioxide, which exacerbates the condition, spike as much as 9% after the plant moved in. Wealthier areas have tried to block the construction of data centers. In November 2024, voters in Warrenton, Virginia, a wealthy exurb of Washington, D.C., replaced town council members who supported a new Amazon data center with an anti-development slate. Ann Wheeler, a Democrat in a neighboring Virginia county who lost her seat over data centers, complained about what she called activists' banana mindset, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone. Data center construction is projected to represent 2-3% of U.S. gross domestic product in the coming years. In the 19th century, the building of the railroads contributed an estimated 6%. Railroads transformed America and generated tremendous, if unevenly distributed, prosperity. But the frenzy also produced one of the largest speculative bubbles in history. The panic of 1893 followed. Unemployment soared, hundreds of banks went out of business, and a surge of populist sentiment destabilized the U.S. political environment. the financier John Gray, the president of the alternative asset manager Blackstone, brought up Ron Chernow's biography of John D. Rockefeller Sr. Many of the railroads went bust, he said. You're trying to avoid this problem because you don't know what the endgame looks like. Blackstone has issued debt to build data centers, not wanting to be among those who go bust. Gray can hedge the risk by securing a 15-year lease agreement from a tech giant such as Microsoft or Amazon, which are some of the most credit-worthy customers in existence. Blackstone typically won't invest in a data center unless it has such a customer lined up. It's not like condos in Miami or Dubai, Gray said. The premise of continued data center construction is that stuffing more NVIDIA chips into the sheds will result in better AI. So far, this has proved true. The latest generation of AI is the most capable ever produced. OpenAI's GPT-5 can even build other, more primitive AIs. Still, it is not an immutable law that more chips equals more intelligence, and researchers are not entirely sure why this scaling effect even exists. It's an empirical question whether we will hit a brick wall, the AI pioneer Demis Hassabis has said of scaling. No one knows. It's also possible that a technological innovation might render hyperscaling obsolete. Earlier this year, when DeepSeek, a Chinese company, unveiled what seemed to be a more efficient training paradigm for AI, NVIDIA's stock plummeted, wiping out almost $600 billion of value in a single day. It has since recovered. Donald Trump has made the construction of data centers a national priority. It has become a kind of ritual for tech executives to announce new projects from the White House. But pandering to Trump might mean stretching the truth. At a White House dinner in September, Mark Zuckerberg said that Meta would spend $600 billion on data centers and related infrastructure in the next few years. With his microphone still live, Zuckerberg leaned toward Trump. "Sorry, I wasn't ready," he whispered. "I wasn't sure what number you wanted to go with." Carrie Person, who manages global data center operations for Amazon, told me that electrical utilities were skeptical of some of the newer data center developers filing requests for power. "If I look at the amount of demand that is in these queues, and I look at the amount of money that would be required to build that out, that amount of money does not exist," Person said. AI, for all its wondrous capabilities, may disappoint investors. It may prove to be an unprofitable commodity. Claude, Grok, Gemini, and ChatGPT all have similar capabilities, and technological innovations are quickly copied by competitors. The tech giants do not, in fact, have unlimited funds, as companies like Microsoft and Meta pour money into the data center race. Their reserves of cash are shrinking. Investors might have unrealistic expectations. The U.S. stock market is approaching valuation ratios last seen during the dot-com era, and the venture capital market has grown frothy. Investors don't usually give a team of six people a couple billion dollars with no product. It's rare, and that's happening today, Jeff Bezos recently said. Then again, it could be that the hype is justified. NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang, whom I published a biography of recently, is a world-class computer scientist who is producing the microchips that make the AI age possible. "We used to get silicon every 2 years," Priest, the Microsoft engineer, said. "Now we get silicon every few months." NVIDIA accounts for roughly 8% of the market capitalization of the S&P 500, the highest concentration in any one stock in at least 45 years. A lot is riding on Huang's ability to keep producing better chips. If Americans want to retire comfortably, NVIDIA has to succeed. Water, power, and land are scarce resources. But the most valuable commodity for a data center, as the name suggests, is data. Claude trained on LibGen, a voluminous corpus of pirated ebooks that can be downloaded by torrent. In September, Anthropic, the developer of Claude, agreed to pay $1.5 billion to the copyright holders of these books, or about $3,000 per infringement, the largest class action copyright infringement settlement in history. I and others at this magazine are among the claimants. Similar lawsuits against OpenAI and NVIDIA are pending. Microsoft does not know what its customers are uploading to its data centers. The data are proprietary. It is difficult to judge the scale of copyright infringement in the AI era, but my guess is that it makes Napster look like a mixtape swap. The modern approach to AI development has been to vacuum up any online data available, including audio, video, practically all published work in English, and more than 3 billion web pages, and let lawyers sort through the mess. But there is now talk of a data shortage. There are thought to be about 400 trillion words on the indexed internet, but as the OpenAI co-founder, Andrej Karpathy, has noted, much of that is total garbage. High-quality text is harder to find. If trends continue, researchers say, AI developers could exhaust the usable supply of human text between 2026 and 2032. Since AI chatbots are recycling existing work, they rely on cliché, and their phrasing grows stale quickly. It's difficult to get fresh, high-quality writing out of them. I have tried. Priest of Microsoft told me that she wasn't concerned about running out of data. There is a universe beyond text, and AI developers are just beginning to explore it. The next frontier is world model data, which will be used to train robots. Streams of video and spatial data will be fed into the data centers, which will be used to develop autonomous robots. Huang of NVIDIA wants to be in this market too, and last year appeared on stage with two mobile androids. In Los Angeles, I have paused behind driverless cars and recently stumbled into an autonomous delivery wagon, but it was on a recent visit to Beijing that I began to understand what the robot revolution was going to look like. Robots are everywhere in China. I saw them stocking shelves and cleaning floors in a mall. When I ordered food to my hotel room, it was delivered by a 2-foot-tall wheeled robot in the shape of a trash can with the voice of a child. I opened my door, nonplussed, to find it standing in front of me, decorated with an ersatz butler's outfit and chirping in Mandarin. A hatch on the front of the robot popped open and a tray of noodles slid out. The machine chirped again. I took my food, the hatch closed, and the robot wheeled away. I stood there for a time holding the tray, wondering if I would ever talk to a human again. And finishing the podcast, we'll go with Briefly Noted. The first book is titled A Garden and a Thief by Megha Manjumdar and published by Knopf. Set in the near future in a version of Kolkata afflicted by food scarcity and dramatic global warming, this adroitly plotted novel centers on the manager of a homeless shelter who isn't above dipping into its donations to feed her young daughter and widower father. The three are days away from flying to the United States to join the woman's husband when a shelter resident sneaks into their home and absconds with their food and inadvertently their passports. A finalist for the National Book Award, Manjumdar's unstintingly graceful political novel has the grip of a nail-biter as the woman, the thief she must track down, and their fellow city dwellers take advantage of morality's elastic borders in times of existential threat. The next book is titled Trip by Amy Barrowdale and published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. The title of this brilliantly strange, funny, and moving novel refers to many things, among them a journey across the Atlantic, the quasi-psychedelic quality of dying, and a boy by that name. At the novel's outset, Tripp's mother travels to Nepal to attend a conference for people who study death. While there, she dies in a freak accident. At the same time, Tripp, who has autism, runs away, ending up on a road trip with a recovering addict. As the mother lingers in spirit form, trying to communicate with the living in order to save Tripp from calamity by possessing the body of another conference goer, for instance, she faces the prospect of losing the attachments that defined her. "You'll forget everything," she's told, after lovingly relating a list of details about her son. The next book is titled Ready for My Close-Up by David M. Lubin and published by Grand Central. In the late 1940s, Hollywood was in transition. The blacklist was demolishing careers. The studio system was imploding, and television was emptying movie theaters. The noir film Sunset Boulevard, which came out in 1950, reflected this destabilization. The film focuses on two Hollywood cast-offs, an aging former star and a floundering screenwriter who becomes her kept man. This scrupulous account of the making of the film, initially conceived as a comedy starring Mae West, traces how it became a history of Hollywood that mocked an entire industry on the edge of collapse or reinvention, depending on whom you asked. The final book is titled The Eternal Forest by Elena Shepherd and published by St. Martin's. On Christmas Eve in 1960, a woman named Rosita fled Castro's revolution in Cuba, boarding a flight with her two daughters to what she assumed would be temporary exile in Miami. She lived for another 60 years, but never returned to the island. In this artfully rendered memoir, Shepherd, Rosita's U.S.-born granddaughter, flits back and forth between the centuries, weaving Cuban history together with familial lore. She seeks to articulate her inherited sense of dislocation while grappling openly with the challenges of narrating a loss that was never entirely hers. "I have tried and failed at feeling what it was like to leave," she writes. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Dale with The New Yorker. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.